every penny. I imagine agencies make themselves seem impressive to different people in different ways. Maybe some people get off on the in-house movie theater or the embroidered wallpaper. Others might like that every single desk had a large live orchid on it. This photograph was aimed at people like me, to make us think, oh, okay, this place is legit. Everyone else, of course, kept walking while I froze, staring at the photo. It took them a while to notice I was gone, but eventually the cute assistant guy came back for me. April, I'm sorry we lost you. His voice was sweet and soft and made me believe it was legitimately their fault I'd been left behind.
What you're looking at is Cindy Sherman's untitled film still number 56, part of her untitled film still series. Each photograph is of the artist, but she has set herself into various roles with the goal of making it more clear that our culture has constructed ideas of gender that can control us if we let them.
I knew all this, but I let him finish because I thought it was nice that he didn't just bark at me for standing in the hallway like a dolt. I figured they made everyone learn a bit about the art so that the whole thing could seem more impressive. Did I mention it was working? Thanks, I said, because I didn't know what else to say. We turned from the photo and started walking.
The agency has a large collection. Some works given to us by clients, others collected by leaders of the company and loaned to us to display. The Sherman, I believe, was provided by Mrs. Putnam.
As we walked, we passed a number of other extraordinary pieces of art. The walls were gallery white, and every 20 feet or so there was a photograph or painting or mixed media piece. I estimate that we walked by at least $2 million worth of art on the way to Jennifer Putnam's office. All around us while we walked, the business of contemporary show business was happening. This apparently meant mostly phone calls. There was also a fair amount of bustling about keyboards and remarkably little chit-chat. We walked by a young woman whom I did not recognize but who was very clearly rich and famous. It's funny how you can just tell, even if you've never seen them before. High fashion is astoundingly different from regular clothes, but I mostly knew because the three people walking behind her had a very clear air of, don't you dare even think about asking for a selfie. And that was the state I was in when I walked into the office of one of the most high-powered agents in the world. Robin, you found her. Welcome, April. Her voice was not loud exactly, just strong. Surprisingly forceful. She was physically nondescript, short gray hair, average height, in good shape. Her voice was her most particular characteristic. This was a woman who could cast spells on people. Her office wasn't huge, but it had a nice view. The shelves were full of books, video games, DVDs, even board games. It read more like a gallery of achievements than a place to store things she liked. Every one of those things was a deal she'd made, and the shelves were full. There was enough room for the four of us to sit comfortably, but a fifth would have been stretching it. Robin was standing by the door. She was admiring the Sherman.
I see you've got good taste. I bought that at auction just a few months ago. Managed to get it a nice place on the walls here, despite the fact that most people couldn't care less about Sherman anymore.
I found this to be an odd thing to say, considering that she probably paid more than $50,000 for that photo, but I didn't say anything.
Anyhow, it's been quite a week for you. I've been following every moment of it. Fascinating. And you're handling it so well. Last night was fantastic. You're viral all over again.
I was confused for a moment, but then remembered the late-night show we had been on. It felt like remembering high school English class.
Thanks, it occurred to me that I had no idea what the game plan was, and I was way too tired to pretend, so I just said it.
So what are we doing here?
Well, Marshall, she indicated Andy's dad, has been telling me about the two of you, and we all just thought it made sense to get you in here and talk about where you want to go from here. There are going to be a number of opportunities, and we want to make sure we go through those doors while they're open.
She talked faster than anyone I've ever heard in real life. Staccato, almost like a slam poem. It was pleasantly peculiar. It was not lost on me that she'd already switched from you to we.
Well, I looked at Andy, who gave me a little shrug. I interpreted that as, play it how you want to play it, girl. So I played it wide open.
Last night, some information came to light that might change all of this. According to a report that I received from a credible source, it may not be long before people in positions of power publicly confirm that the Carls are not from Earth. The words hung in the air for a while.
Jennifer Putnam looked at Andy's dad, who looked worriedly at Andy, who looked at me. I also would have looked at me if I had been capable of it, but I couldn't because I was me. My impulse was to look down at my hands, but I knew that that was wrong, so I just looked at Putnam, who was, by this time, looking back at me.
Robin, I'm going to need you to cancel all my calls for the next 2 hours.
Yes, Mrs. Putnam. If this was unusual, they made no sign that it was. The door closed quietly behind Robin. And what information is this?
A materials scientist from UC Berkeley that I've been in correspondence with says that the properties of the Carls are impossible. Not weird or expensive or new, but according to everything we know, simply not possible.
And you trust her?
She seems trustable, I said, feeling a little bit like maybe I was a complete idiot. But if Putnam was skeptical, she didn't show it.
But also, I have not told you the whole story. I need you to assure me 100% that you will not tell anyone what I am about to tell you.
I can have Robin work up a quick NDA if you would like. But if my word is enough, you have it, Putnam said.
So I told her about the Freddie Mercury sequence and what Miranda had figured out, and that we were planning to make a video about it. I did not tell her that we thought the sequence was a request for physical material and that we were planning on providing it. Frankly, I knew deep in my heart that that was a selfish and foolish thing to do, and I didn't want them to talk me out of it. I'm not much older now than I was then, but in a lot of ways, obviously, I'm a different person. So it is easy for me to recognize that I made some good decisions and some bad ones. But it's telling that, with this, I knew it was a bad idea even then, but I still couldn't control myself. Knowing something is a bad idea does not always decrease the odds that you will do it. If I had examined my motivations on this one, I probably wouldn't have liked what I found. So I didn't. After I'd finished telling her about the sequence and that we'd figured it out, Jennifer Putnam said,
"Well then, the situation has changed, but the question has not. April, Andy, what do you want out of this? You can, if you're right, have anything.
You hear about Hollywood agents promising young stars everything. The sun, the moon, the stars, whatever you want, if you only sign right here. But the way it came out of Jennifer Putnam's mouth, I believed it. The power of the whole thing flooded into me. The Sherman photograph, the confidence on national TV, the knowing of things no one else knew. It was candy, Christmas morning, and a first kiss all rolled into one. So I gave her the elevator pitch. We have already created a strategy. We want the idea of April May to be a counterbalance to the idea of the Carls. Where they're powerful, I will be weak. Where they're terrifying, I'll be cute. Where they're otherworldly, I'll be human. We would like to build the idea of April May to help people deal with the reality of Carl. And once I have that platform, use it to bring people together and promote simple change in a better world. I didn't really know what simple change I wanted to promote exactly. That seemed like the kind of thing I'd figure out once I had the power. In any case, Putnam loved every second of that. But Mr. Scamped did not. I sometimes imagine what it would have been like if he hadn't been in the room. The thing about getting famous is that often the only people who are in a position to be honest with you about the realities of celebrity are the people who will make gobs of money if you go all in. They have no incentive to tell you the dirty truth, which Mr. Scamped attempted to tell me then.
April, this is a huge decision. Becoming involved with something like this, it's going to completely take over. People will hate you for no reason, or for bad reasons, or even for good reasons. People are torn apart by fame, and this is far beyond what most of them deal with. You're talking about yourself like you're a tool, but you're a person too, and an evolving one. This will affect your life forever.
Putnam addressed me, not Andy's dad.
These are concerns that I absolutely share. You will never know what this is going to be like until you do it. And fame is not something that should be sought for its own sake. That being said, I think there are safe ways to approach this, and it is very good that you are here. We need to talk about a lot of things, and you should know that you can back out at any time.
That's not exactly true, Jennifer, said Mr. Scamped.
Once they're in this, there's only so much that they'll be able to withdraw.
The sea of dopamine and adrenaline enveloping my brain was converting my exhaustion to giddiness.
How can we say no? We're in.
I turned to Andy, who hadn't spoken since we walked into the office. He looked down at his feet for a second before he said,
What she said. No one gets this opportunity. We need to take it.
Okay, we need to do quite a lot of work very fast. How are you two feeling?
Putnam asked.
Terrible, I said. Like I got fucked by a demon, Andy added.
His dad looked displeased.
Jennifer Putnam did not. Well, I guess that's what we're working with, she said.
Over the next couple of hours, Robin and Mrs. Putnam built contracts, made phone calls, and quizzed Andy and me. Mr. Scamped made it clear that, in this situation, he was representing the clients, not the company, and argued with Putnam on a number of points that I was far too exhausted to understand. We had absolutely lucked out to have Mr. Scamped fighting like a dog for us. He probably saved our butts and our dollars in 50 different ways in the course of 15 minutes. The weirdest bit was when they separated Andy and me for one-on-one discussions. They wanted to make sure that one of us wasn't influencing the other, and they asked us about that and about the deal we'd brokered and about our relationship. I mean, I presume they asked Andy about all the same stuff. If they asked him something different, he never told me. I was as open as I could be. Andy and I were on good standing, and it looked as if there was more than enough money to go around, and what did I need more than $20,000 a month for anyway? Then there was the bit I really wasn't expecting.
Is there anything we should know about you? Putnam asked.
I'm a Libra?
Mr. Scamped chimed in.
April, it's important that if there's anything that might come to light under scrutiny, we know about it now.
Oh, I hadn't thought about this. Yeah, nothing I can think of?
Okay, well, we have some prompts.
And then he rifled off dozens of terrible things I might have done, just in case they'd slipped my mind. Had I ever hit a dog with my car?
A person?
Had I had a relationship with someone who was much younger than me? Much older than me? Had I ever hired a prostitute? Been a prostitute? Sold drugs? Done drugs? Seen drugs? Killed with my bare hands? Collected the teeth of my vanquished enemies? Carved the bones of children into weapons with which I killed yet more children? And if it's not too much to ask, could you please write down the name of every single person you've ever been to first base with? I answered these questions and did these things, and it was extremely uncomfortable. But I had the feeling that it was a test as well as a practical exercise.
April, I can't help but notice that there are a lot of names of both genders on this list, Putnam said in a way that both was and was not a question.
Well, a lot? I wouldn't say a lot, I said, completely comfortable and not at all embarrassed by this line of questioning. That's sarcasm, by the way.
Jennifer, Andy's dad said, I don't know that that's any of our business.
She replied like he was a child.
Marshall, you know as well as I do that it could soon be everyone's business.
Mr. Scamped looked cowed.
April, Putnam continued, are you dating anyone at the moment?
Yeah, Maya. We were roommates first. It's a little weird, but we have a great relationship.
As I said this, I felt a huge wave of guilt wash over me, as I realized I still hadn't texted her since she sent that "What's up, hun?" text.
So, she continued, would it be okay if you were just gay? Like, you've had relationships with guys in the past but were gay the whole time?
But I happen to not be just gay. I'm gay and straight.
It's great. I don't even know what it would be like to not be attracted to a person because of their gender. To me, you're the weird one.
It's hard not to be immediately defensive when people challenge you on your sexuality, no matter what it is. Some people just can't seem to believe that I feel the way I do. And so suddenly they're off explaining me to themselves with me sitting right there. Is it that I'm greedy or sex-crazed or can't make up my mind or I'm a lesbian but I can't admit it or that I'm just doing it to get guys' attention because they think it's hot? And if not that, then... Oh, by the way, my girlfriend's bi too. Maybe we can, meaningful pause, hang out sometime.
April, I absolutely understand, but not everybody will. I'm just saying that it would be simpler if you were either straight or gay. I have no issue with bisexuality, and I want very much for the rest of the world to feel that way too, but it would distract from your message. Some people will latch onto this as a way to make you less human. We're looking at this through not just a New York City lens, but all of America. Really, all of the world. Your sexual orientation will be a weakness through which you can be attacked.
I looked down at the floor and stayed silent for a full 10 seconds.
I mean, yeah, it made some sense. We're dealing with fucking space aliens,
Who gives a shit if I'm gay or bi? I looked up at Mr. Scamped, who just shrugged. I mean, it's not like I'm currently thinking about hooking up with any dudes, I said, sort of lying, since I had just been thinking about hooking up with Robin. But Mr. Scamped's silence sounded like agreement to me, so I caved. Sure, yeah, I can just be gay. That was the first time I got a glimpse of the ways in which Jennifer Putnam sucked as a human being, and I didn't even notice it in the moment. I know I'm blaming her when I could just as easily blame myself, but I was confused and out of my depth, and she seemed so competent. For her, it was easier to sell a quirky lesbian than a quirky bi girl, so I became a quirky lesbian for her. Though I'm not sure I'm one to talk, but with the whole staying up until 10 a.m. very intentionally converting myself into a brand, our goals, most of the time, would align. After everyone was satisfied that I had never eaten even a single baby, I was released for a coffee break, which I had with Andy at a cafe across the street. We debriefed and talked war stories. I kept the bi thing from him, and I'm sure he kept some stuff from me. Whatever. Neither of us had ever done anything terrible. That was the important thing. I'd been texting Miranda on and off throughout the day. She had left Berkeley and was on her way to Los Angeles now. We were going to meet her at the CVS, not a Walmart, alas, that was closest to the Carl in Los Angeles. Hollywood Carl. Of course, LA traffic was conspiring against her, but this meeting with Putnam was taking way more time than we'd expected anyway, so it was working out pretty perfectly. I still hadn't texted Maya. I couldn't figure out how. There was so much to say and so much to do, and honestly, I was afraid of how she'd respond to the day's events. In my mind, I could only hear her on the spectrum from disappointed to livid. I didn't feel like there would be excitement or support on the other side of that conversation, so I just kept not having it. Hey, April? Andy had been looking at his phone. More Carl weirdness. Nobody's saying he's a space alien, but they tried to move the one in Oakland to a slightly more convenient spot because he was causing traffic problems and they couldn't. He broke their crane. The story reads like it was inept city management or crane operators or something. I'm guessing it's more than that. I stared into my coffee as the magnitude of it all crashed down on me once again. This just kept happening. I'd be living my normal life, being me inside of me, the way I'd always been, and then I'd remember. It was a little like how I felt a couple of years before when our cat Spotlight died. You keep forgetting that life is never going to be the same again, but you can only go so long without thinking, "Where's Spotlight? I haven't seen him all..." Oh. Fuck. Oh God, Andy, this is really happening, isn't it?
Jennifer Putnam sure seems to think so, he said, as I dosed myself with another sip of coffee.
Now, with a better understanding of her business and of her, I realize that Jennifer Putnam didn't need to be sure Carl was a space alien to go full war room. She only needed there to be a chance. She needed to look like she was all in, even if she believed there was only a 5% chance we were right. Because even a 5% chance of making tens of millions of dollars was more than worth her while. In the end, if Carl wasn't an alien, we would still be her client, and she could point to her faith and belief in us. It was a win-win for her. When we walked back into her office after our coffee break, she said quickly and carefully, "April, I'm giving you Robin. You need a full-time assistant right now, and it's much easier for me to get a replacement than for you to find someone trustworthy. He's fantastic. A little soft-spoken, but ridiculously effective. We'll continue paying him, but he'll work for you. He'll be in your email, if that's all right, and possibly doing some social media. We're going to make it clear to him that he works for you, not me." Mr. Scamps didn't look extremely pleased about this, but conceded. "We don't think it would be wise to involve anyone else at this point." "So, you officially have an employee. They make your life easier, but only if you use them. If you are not telling him to get you coffee at least once per day, he will literally feel offended. He is there for you. You need him, and he wants to help." "Does Robin know any of this?" I asked. Jennifer Putnam picked up her phone and hit a button. "Robin, can you come in for a moment?" 10 seconds later, he was in the room.
"Yes, Mrs. Putnam?"
"How would you feel about working for Ms. May?"
"I would be honored."
He gave a little bow. "You would be what?" I replied. "People don't talk like that."
"Ms. May, I've known you for a very short period of time,
but you appear to be strong, proud, and driven by good values. More than that, however, you are at the very center of history. If this is real, people will remember it for a very, very long time. I would not, he paused, mind being a part of that.
I would also not mind him being a part of it. He seemed really nice, significantly less skeezy than Putnam, and roughly my age, which made it less weird to think about him working for me. The only problem with this was that Robin was attractive. He was cute enough that Maya would immediately know how attractive I found him. And he was going to be my assistant. This guy would be all up inside of my everything. Phrasing April. He would be very involved in my life. But you can't not hire someone because they're too cute, can you? That definitely sounds illegal. So, there it was. I had an assistant. Well, thanks, Robin. It's a pleasure to both meet and employ you. Please help me. I feel as if every page of unread emails removes a year from my lifespan. With the following words, I give you the power to save or destroy me. My password is Donkey Fart. Chapter 7. We were finally free from the agency at around 7 p.m. The sane thing would have been to go to the hotel, get some sleep, and make a careful plan for the morning. But we were, or rather I was, high on caffeine and feeling invincible. I'd already set up evening plans to visit and maybe experiment on Hollywood Carl with Miranda the night before. Going to the hotel seemed ludicrous. Later, Andy would describe it to me this way. Carl just had too much mass. We couldn't stop falling into his gravity any more than we could jump to the moon. So we fell. I assumed we were going to take a lift, but Robin seemed to think that would have been a personal insult to him, and also it wasn't precisely secure to make a video about secret space aliens in a stranger's car. So with Robin driving, we got to film on the way. I sat in the front seat with the camera. The video starts with me recording myself. Hello, and welcome to Robin's car. This is Robin. I turn the camera to Robin, who waves, teeth gleaming. We have news. Several days ago, Andy and I turn the camera to Andy, who waves, discovered what we have come to call the Freddie Mercury sequence. This is a cascade of changes that occur if you attempt to correct typos on the Wikipedia page for Queen's hit song, Don't Stop Me Now. The meaning of these changes remains something of a mystery. However, thanks to the help of a materials scientist from UC Berkeley, we now believe that we have decoded the sequence. We are headed to Hollywood Boulevard now to meet that scientist and to test a little theory. Here in the final video, we cut to a screenshot of the Wikipedia page and some voiceover of me talking about the sequence, how we discovered it, and Miranda's later discovery that the citation numbers also changed, and that those numbers corresponded to chemical elements. Miranda was sitting on the curb of the CVS on Hollywood Boulevard when Robin dropped us off. The moment she saw us, she popped to her feet and ran over to give me a hug. This is so cool! It is not cool! She was a little taller than I expected her to be because of how she was not exactly average height. I'm short. I barely came up to her collarbone when she hugged me. It wasn't one of those A-frame hugs either. She smooshed our bodies together like I'd known her from kindergarten. Her bright eyes were glinting with excitement. Miranda is a bit older than me, but she looks a little younger. Seeing her was another flood of reality. This was happening. We were going to visit Carl, to give him materials to see what would happen. We were really doing it. I'm sorry, was that too much hug? She looked worried. Nope, that was a perfect amount of hug. She smiled at me, looking like she didn't quite believe it and would later be chastising herself for her enthusiasm. I got some smoke detectors this morning. They don't make it easy to get the americium out, so I'm glad I did it back at the lab. She pulled a box out of her purse and opened it to show a small vial with a couple of silvery metal strips inside. Andy came from around the other side of the car as Robin drove away to find parking. Glad you got it out, he told her. But let's go buy another one so we can show where we got it from. Oh, Miranda's excitement mingled a tiny bit with embarrassment. I wasn't thinking about the video. Oh, this is so cool. Am I going to be in it? If that's okay with you,
Andy said. He took some establishing shots of the outside of the CVS, and then we recorded a quick intro with Miranda. We have arrived at the CVS just a block away from Hollywood Carl with Miranda Beckwith, the materials scientist who solved the Freddie Mercury sequence. What are we doing here, Miranda? We're buying smoke detectors. That seems like a really weird thing to be doing. This is not a normal day. Her excitement was fantastic on film. And why are we buying smoke detectors? To me, the sequence is pretty clear, Miranda began. Carl's asking for supplies, and one of those supplies is americium, which is a fairly rare element, but it is used in some commercial products as a source of alpha particles. She had deftly avoided using the word radioactive. Do I need to know what that means? Not really, no. It's interesting, though. Maybe we'll put an explanation in the description. All that's important is that inside of this smoke detector, she held up the box, is about 1/5,000th of a gram of americium. Is that going to be enough? Oh, I have no idea. It depends on what Carl wants it for. If he needs it for a catalytic reaction, any amount will probably do. If he needs it to actually construct something, no, this will probably not be enough. Do I need to know what that means? Miranda looked into the lens. More information in the video's description. Also, don't forget to subscribe! The placement of the Carls was, of course, a topic of considerable discussion. They were impossible to move, and they invariably showed up in urban areas where they wouldn't go unnoticed. But in every city, their locations seemed non-random, but also not consistent. For example, they all showed up on a sidewalk, but the part of town they were in was random. Oakland Carl was the only Carl in the San Francisco Bay Area, and San Franciscans were frankly offended. Manhattan is a city of somewhat uniform interestingness. New York Carl showed up on a well-trafficked street, but most streets in Manhattan have heavy pedestrian traffic. It's not like he showed up on Fifth Avenue, Times Square, or Madison Avenue. There was nothing particularly special about New York Carl's spot in front of a Chipotle. Hollywood Carl, on the other hand, showed up in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, one of the city's major tourist spots and probably the most heavily trafficked pedestrian spot in LA. Not only that, but it's a place frequented by street performers and phony costumed superheroes, charging $20 per photo. Knowing all this about Hollywood Boulevard and America's obsession with fame, I should not have been so surprised when we walked down to the theater and found a line stretching from Carl off so deep into the distance that it might as well have been infinite. This was, after all, a real-life Carl. People come to the Walk of Fame to get their picture taken with a celebrity's star or their handprints in the cement. These people are the most likely folks in the world to want something for the scrapbook. The theater had even set up some lights so the Carl was more visible for nighttime photographs. They shone harshly on his shiny bits. I don't know why we hadn't assumed that there would be a line, but there it was. Oh, Lord, Andy said. Are we going to wait in that? I replied. The three of us began to wander down the line, trying to see the end. Eventually, I caved and just walked up to a young woman who was 20 or so people back in the line and asked, "How long have you been waiting?" Her eyes widened and her mouth became a perfect circle. "Oh, my God," she said, with equal and emphatic weight on every syllable. And then she turned to a friend. "Oh, my God, Allison, it's April, May, April, oh, my God." Miranda and Andy just stared. Every culture has its ways of turning strangers into acquaintances. We don't really think about these procedures, they just exist. And this process almost always begins either by telling someone your name or by having some third party introduce you. Which is why I replied to someone who had just yelled my own name at me by telling them what my name was. "Hey, hi, it's nice to meet you. I'm April," I said. "Of course you're April," the woman replied. It may be worth saying that usually the second party in the stranger-to-stranger introduction responds to your telling them your name by telling you theirs. And yet this had not happened, which made the conversation even more difficult to have. I would eventually get used to all this, but at the moment, as the cultural systems for stranger-to-stranger conversation had completely broken down, I had no idea what to say. Robin appeared out of nowhere, apparently having found a parking spot. "Do you want to get a picture with April?" He sounded calm and kind and like he really cared. And then there was much fumbling for cameras and, oh, actually, that was a video, and can you take one with me and with Allison and then one with us both? And, oh, Allison's phone is out of space, and don't worry, we'll just take it on my phone, and I'll text it to you later. And then it was done. Suddenly, there was a hubbub, and everyone around us was aware that someone famous had showed up. I got the feeling that even if they hadn't known who I was, every person in that line would have wanted a picture. And Allison and her friends were not like the high school group at LAX. They were freaking out. The good news was that, one, everyone else nearby in the line also wanted a picture, and, two, we had now effectively cut in line and were only 20 people back, but nobody was complaining. We were saved by the existing line. No one wanted to get out of the car line they'd been waiting in. Otherwise, I would have been completely encircled, and someone may have needed to call the cops. Luckily, we were able to selfie our way to the front of the line, and it only took about 5 minutes. Once we were up there, Andy, who had been filming much of my fan interaction, made an announcement to everyone within earshot.
We'll now be making a quick video with Hollywood Carl here. It will only take a few minutes, and April will be available to take pictures for a few minutes afterward. Thank you all for your patience.
Everyone seemed thrilled. And with that, we resumed the video with both Miranda and me on screen. I look almost comically short beside her long, thin body, but Carl's chest isn't even in the frame, since he's 10 feet tall. In the background, spectators are gathering around to watch us film, and behind them, Grauman's Chinese Theater. The line of adoring Carl fans has graciously allowed us to cut, a clip of the line showed over this, so that we can get down to the business of giving Carl a little of what he asked for. Miranda? We believe that Carl asked for 3 chemical elements, right?
Yes, Miranda chimed in, confident and on cue.
Isotopes of iodine, americium, and uranium. We have iodine, which can be found in any number of products. I have secured lab-grade purified iodine crystals and americium, which we carefully and properly extracted from a household smoke detector. She had done this with pliers and wire cutters.
And is that americium safe?
Not really, no. If you were to ingest it, you might die. Just to be safe, I'm wearing gloves. Definitely don't eat this stuff, though.
I will keep that in mind.
We decided, however, that we would not attempt to secure any uranium for Carl. Though non-purified uranium is safe and available for purchase, it seemed a bit much for this initial experiment.
What do you think will happen, Miranda?
I asked.
I have no idea.
She seemed surprised that I was asking her non-scientific questions.
What do you hope will happen?
That's not really how I think about things. In science, you're not supposed to hope. You experiment and observe. But if anything, I guess I just hope that something happens.
So what do we do now?
Let's start with the iodine. Put on your gloves.
I put my gloves on.
I'll be honest. The realization that we were actually doing this and what it could result in never really struck me. We just did it. Like Andy said, we were falling into Carl's gravity. I was making decisions. Pretty stupid ones. But it didn't feel like that for me in the moment.
Is iodine dangerous?
No, it's actually used as a nutritional supplement. They put it in salt to prevent goiters. It's also used as a catalyst in organic chemical reactions, which is, if I had to guess, why Carl wants it.
Miranda shook a tiny, silvery-looking flake out of a vial into my outstretched hand.
I then held that hand out to Carl. Andy pulled out into a wide shot to show me, barely breaking 5 feet, holding my latex-gloved hand out to this 10-foot-tall transformer. I look pretty much exactly like a confused monkey trying to make peace with a superior life form. Nothing happened, of course.
Try direct contact, Miranda said.
Cut, Andy said. I want to get in close on this.
Andy moved in to film me pinching the flake of iodine out of the palm of my left hand, and then without any visible sign of the fear and anticipation that was shooting through my body, I reached out to press it onto the back of Carl's right hand. Heat. I felt heat. And then suddenly I was lightheaded and nauseated.
Ugh,
I said, staggering slightly. Suddenly, Robin appeared from nowhere at my side.
April, are you okay?
Andy said from behind the camera. Everyone suddenly looked quite scared,
maybe realizing that we, in fact, had no idea what we were doing. But then the feeling passed.
Yes, I said, shaking my head. Yeah, I think I felt my finger get warm, and then I felt lightheaded for a moment.
I looked down at my hand. The flake of iodine was gone. Whether any of that had actually happened, or I had just imagined it, was immediately unclear to me. There were a lot of reasons for me to be feeling lightheaded right then, and the sensation of warmth through a latex glove isn't exactly a precise, measurable phenomenon. And it was a tiny flake. I might have just dropped it. Miranda immediately attempted the same with her own flake of iodine and reported that nothing happened. Of course, we cut that from the video because... boring. We talked for a little bit about whether we should continue. I felt totally normal by this point, and the fact that Miranda hadn't felt anything made me think maybe I hadn't either. So the next line in the video is Miranda saying, "Well, I call those results inconclusive. April May, would you like to try the americium? Seems like the thing to do." This little strip of metal, Miranda held it up for the audience to see, contains a tiny, tiny fraction of a gram of americium, a radioactive metal produced as part of the decay cycle of plutonium. April, would you like to see if Carl is interested in it? Again, I took the strip in my latex-gloved hand and pressed it firmly to the back of Carl's hand. I think I feel a little warmth again, no dizziness. I pulled my hand back, but the little strip of metal was still there. The strip didn't disappear like the iodine did, I reported, more to Miranda than to the camera. The strip is not pure americium, so there was bound to be stuff left over. I should have had someone else do it so you could have felt the warmth to make sure I wasn't imagining it, I said. That would have been a slightly better experimental design, yes, Miranda replied. But honestly, this entire thing has been a travesty of science. Nothing about what we did today would even be considered for peer review. We stood there for another few seconds while nothing continued to happen. Finally, Andy lowered his camera and said to Robin, "Okay, well, maybe time for you to go get the car so we..." Holy fuck! Andy froze, staring at the place where I had pressed the americium for a tiny moment before frantically grabbing at the DSLR and thumbing the record button, just in time. Soundlessly, smoothly, Carl's hand had begun to move. Andy got about 2 seconds of that movement before the hand disconnected from the body with a soft click and dropped to the ground. Stunned silence became sounds of exclamation from the crowd, from me as well. My particular sound we could not include in the final video because we wanted it to be child-friendly. Carl's hand, as big as a dinner plate, hit the cement, flipped itself over so its fingers touched the ground, and then it ran. I say it ran because that's the closest word I have to what it did, which was that it pushed itself up on the tips of all 5 fingers and then skittered away, clicking rapidly down the sacred marble of the Hollywood Walk of Fame, causing yelps and leaps of surprise as tourists spotted it. The line behind us rapidly devolved as people rushed to see what was happening or began running in fear. We spent a precious few seconds staring in absolute shock, which I think is understandable, before Miranda shot after it just a millisecond before Andy and I had the same idea. We shoved our way through Los Angeles's only busy sidewalk like perps in a crime movie. I pretty much bounced off a Chewbacca who was posing with a lovely middle-aged couple. I caught a glimpse of the hand as it hung a right on orange and increased my speed to match my certainty that this was a thing that was actually happening, and also thanks to the complete lack of pedestrian traffic just 3 feet off the Walk of Fame. I flew around the corner and saw it just 20 or 30 feet ahead, but now somehow galloping? Instead of individual steps, it was moving in a leaping gait. Andy stopped as he turned on orange to film me chasing after the hand a bit before following. Miranda and I did not stop. We flew past the parking garages and hotels and apartment complexes on orange. I was not and have never been an athlete. Miranda, on the other hand, showed no signs of slowing down, so I did everything I could to keep up with her. Orange dead ends into Franklin, but Miranda and I both distinctly saw Carl's hand head straight across Franklin and then leap over a small orange retaining wall. I followed a few strides behind Miranda, up a steep, curving driveway, and up to a frickin' castle? What? I said as I gasped for air. The fuck?
Though it was dark, the building was lit by a number of dramatic sources. It had weird, surprising architectural details like turrets and faux crenellations. After the apartment buildings and shopping centers we had just run past, I had the sudden disorienting feeling that maybe Carl had created a portal and we had been transported to some kind of kitschy Narnia. I looked behind us, and Franklin Avenue was still there, bustling with traffic. I decided that this was still the real world and marched past the valet parking sign and up to a young man in a tuxedo.
"Did you see a large robotic hand run by here just now?" I said, having caught enough of my breath to speak.
"Hmm?" he said, as if he were just realizing we were talking to him. "Ah, yes, it just went inside."
"What?"
"Well, it walked up and looked as if it wanted to go inside, so I let it inside. It had not strictly obeyed the dress code, but while the rules are both specific and comprehensive, I thought it made sense to allow an exception in the case of an autonomous hand." He did not seem to think this was all that weird. Miranda attempted a response.
Well, we're...
And she failed in her attempt.
"We need to get in there,"
I interrupted. The man, maybe in his late 20s, dressed in a full tuxedo and white gloves, looked us up and down before saying, "Are you members?" As if he already very much knew the answer.
No, but you just let a robotic hand into the club, why not us?
"Well, first, you are not members. Second, and I don't mean this as any kind of criticism, but you are not in compliance with the dress code."
"But a robot hand is?" I said, amazed.
"There's nothing in the rules about robot hands."
"Look," I said, "can we just take a quick peek around?
Are you members?"
"No, we are still not members," I said, losing patience.
"I'm very sorry. There is..."
I just pushed past him. I mean, I'm not big, but he wasn't a real bouncer. This clearly wasn't a rough-and-tumble kind of bar. It was some fancy club, and this guy wasn't used to physically throwing people out. I pushed past through the door, Miranda on my heels, and found myself in a small room with dark wood paneling, a few small potted trees, and a fair number of bookshelves. Two more 20-somethings stood behind a desk. The man tumbled in after us.
"Nika, I'm sorry, they pushed me." He sounded astonished.
"Did a robotic hand come in here?" I said firmly, still out of breath from the run.
"Hello, I'm Nika. Welcome to the Magic Castle. Are you members?"
She was having none of us.
"The Magic Castle?" "The Magic Castle," Nika replied. "The clubhouse for the Academy of Magical Arts, a members-only club for magicians."
"And this is a real thing?" She didn't reply.
"And that is why you do not think that it's weird that an autonomous hand just walked in," I said. "We have seen weirder things."
I decided to put some of my TV skills to work and attempted to pivot. "Regardless, a robotic hand about 10 inches came through here several minutes ago, and it is very important that I locate it."
"Ma'am, I'm afraid I'm not authorized to discuss our clientele with non-members. Additionally, we cannot allow you admittance, as it would be against our policies, which are very clear. This conversation is over."
I decided that pushing had worked last time, so I started to push my way past them into whatever weirdo freak cult club this was, and then realized why this small room was so strange.
"If you would like to push past us," Nika said, "you are welcome to try."
She gestured to the doorless room.
"What the frick kind of place is this?"
I half yelled. I looked over at Miranda, whose brow was knitted so tightly I thought it might cramp.
"This is the Magic Castle, and I'm afraid I must ask you to leave."
"Okay, so you know how down the street on Hollywood Boulevard there is an unexplained 10-foot-tall robot? Well, his hand just fell off and ran into your club. If I can't come in, can you at least go and look for it?"
Nika finally looked at least interested.
"We will do that. But first, you have to leave."
Seeing no other particular recourse in the doorless room, we left. As we came out of the castle, I pulled my phone, which had been buzzing for several minutes straight, out of my pocket. Andy and Robin were the culprits. I texted them both to say we were at the intersection of North Orange and Franklin because I didn't want to sound absurd asking them to meet us at the Magic Castle.
They were both there in less than a minute. We all piled into Robin's car.
Why does it smell so good in here?
I got in and out, Robin said. I had to guess preferences. I'm not 100% sure that we're even all meat eaters, but there are some animal-style fries for those who aren't.
You are Jesus, I exclaimed, realizing that I was starving. I'll take those fries, Miranda said.
Of course, the beautiful genius was also a vegetarian. A vegetarian consuming fries brought to me by the man whose job was literally to serve me. I should text Maya, I thought. But then there was a double-double in my lap, so I didn't.
We passed the bags around the car as Robin drove us back toward our hotel while we told Robin and Andy about the bizarre incident at the Magic Castle.
I can get you in there, Robin said.
What is it? Miranda asked.
Only magicians can become members, and you can only go inside if you are a member or have been given a guest card by a member. I can probably get one by tomorrow.
I'm afraid that will be way too late. Besides, we have a lot of video to edit. Also, I have tweets to tweet. I got my phone out. At April May Be Not. Just performed a dramatically successful experiment with Hollywood Carl. His hand detached and ran away. I know that sounds absurd, but that's what happened. We have footage, and we'll be uploading the moment we finish editing. At April May Be Not. Carl's hand ran to the Magic Castle, where we were denied entry because we were wearing jeans and are not magicians? Shrug. But again, we have successfully interacted with a Carl, and Hollywood Carl's right hand is now AWOL. Soon after this, I received about 80 tweets linking me to an AP story with the headline, Carl Hands Vanish Across Continents. It wasn't just Hollywood Carl. Every Carl had, in the last hour, lost its right hand. The story was just a couple of lines and didn't make any mention of where the hands had gone or show any pictures or video of hands scampering around Mexico City. It was early, so we didn't understand that there was really only one hand loose. We just knew that every Carl that had been checked was now missing its right hand. Fuck!
I shouted to the whole car, startling Andy, who had already fallen asleep.
What is it, April?
Robin said, concerned from the driver's seat.
It's bigger than we thought. The AP is already out in front of us.
It's almost better to be first than best, but being best is much more work, so I was frustrated. I wanted my tweets to be as viral as my first video. I wanted to be in control of the story. The numbers were clicking up fast, but not as fast as if I'd broken the news. Reporters would start calling soon, so at least I would be part of the story. But it wouldn't be my story. And so I wasn't going to get all the value out of it I could have gotten if I just started tweeting instead of running after the hand. I figured that the news of Hollywood Carl's hand running off would spread quickly, of course, but if all 64 Carl hands had suddenly started roaming around 64 metropolises on 6 different continents, this was already a huge story. And we were behind. I was so scared and frustrated and I didn't even know what I was chasing.
Andy, get out your camera. Let's film an outro and upload now. Robin, can you find us someplace nearby with fast internet?
No,
Robin said.
What?
I replied, shocked at the thought that Robin was incapable of something, anything really.
You don't need to do that. Write an outro, film it tonight, but don't upload it tonight. Let the press freak out. If you upload now, you'll be drowned out. You have big news in that camera, but the news has news for today, tomorrow or the day after.
They'll be jonesing again, Miranda said.
Yes, exactly, said Robin.
But I already tweeted about it, I said, now unsure whether I'd posted too early or too late.
Then you'll be getting lots of media requests, and we will ignore them until the video goes up, and it will just make everyone more excited to see it, Robin said.
Andy added, This is a good plan because also it means I cannot freak out for, like, as many as 4 whole hours. I can edit on the plane and I can sleep now.
And then he added in a bored voice, Chauffeur, take me to my place of unconsciousness and away from this ridiculous woman. Then he leaned back up against the window.
Andy, we are at the crux of history, I said, leaning over the front seat to look at Andy while doing my best American Hermione Granger impression.
April, I am at the crux of violence.
He didn't open his eyes.
What is the crux, anyway?
Miranda asked.
It's like the center of the cross, maybe?
Definitely something to do with a cross, Robin guessed.
You guys, we did that, I said. And we're doing this.
We all looked around the car at one another. None of us older than 25 years old, cruising down Santa Monica Boulevard, planning our press strategy for the announcement of first contact with a space alien. We were all a little punch drunk, so someone began giggling. Within a few seconds, it was everyone, laughing at the absurdity of it all, of that night, of these weeks, of the fact that it was us. We had no right to play this role, but we were playing it. There was whooping and recapping and fist pumping, and Andy roused from his grogginess long enough to let a smile take over his face. Once everybody's cheeks hurt and we had rehashed the whole night one more time, I opened my notes app and started writing a script, which I recorded on that car ride to our hotel while Andy and Miranda slept, Miranda's head lolling on Andy's shoulder. We chased Hollywood Carl's hand down Orange and into the Magic Castle, a club for magicians where we were denied entrance. Staff there, however, reported seeing the hand enter the establishment. It would appear that our interpretation of the Freddie Mercury sequence was correct, and that presenting Carl with americium or iodine or both either caused or allowed Carl's hand to disconnect and move independently around Los Angeles. We do not know where the hand is now. It's now evident that every Carl on every continent has lost his right hand. But while Hollywood Carl's hand was observed running away, multiple videos show other Carl's hands simply vanishing at the exact same time. We don't know what this means, and honestly, we don't know what we've done. But they asked us for materials, and we provided them. It occurs to me now, this had only taken so long to occur to me because I had actively prevented myself from thinking about it, that we took a number of actions today on behalf of all humanity and maybe should have asked for some kind of permission first, or let the government decide if this was the correct course of action. I did not do that. I did not think that the result of our experiment would be so substantial or significant. I have no reason to think, however, that the Carls are anything but friendly at this point. Well, maybe they are also very, very odd. And that's how I ended that video. I looked into the back seat. Miranda's head was resting on Andy's shoulder. It looked like the right thing to do. So for the last 5 minutes before we got to our hotel, I went to sleep. And that was the first time I had the dream. I'm in the lobby of a fancy office, shiny and bright and brand new. Light comes from everywhere, but there are no windows, just wood-paneled walls and gray carpeted floors. There's music playing, but I don't recognize it. No one is around except at a check-in desk, there's a small robot. Well, not small, human-sized. It looks smoother and sleeker than Carl. Blue and white, and no chrome at all. It's approachable, so I approach it. Hello, it says, in a smooth, human-sounding male voice. Hello, I'm here to see Carl, I say.
Do you have a passcode?
The robot behind the desk responds. No? I reply skeptically. Then I woke up to find that we'd arrived at our hotel. Discussions had occurred while I was unconscious. Miranda needed a place to sleep, so Robin offered to get her a room at our hotel just to save on driving around. Andy's and my flight was leaving in 6 hours, so we would actually get to have a solid 4 hours of sleep in real beds. We were all zombies, but Andy and I more than anyone. Andy was humming a weird little tune as we waited for Miranda to finish at the check-in desk. The song was familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. We all rode the elevator up together. Miranda was humming the same weird song Andy was. God, what is that song? It's so familiar. You've both been humming it, I said to Miranda and Andy. Was all Andy could manage. Sorry, I didn't even realize I was humming, Miranda replied sleepily. I looked at Robin, since he was good at solving problems.
Sorry, April. It doesn't sound familiar to me.
We all headed to our separate rooms. I did not take off my clothes, but I did take out my phone. I stared at the gobs of tweets coming in. I'd added more than 10,000 followers since I posted about the hand. I wasn't even interacting. I wasn't learning about my audience, I was just watching it grow.
My phone felt like it weighed 10 pounds in my hands, and I almost fell asleep. But then I realized I'd been neglecting Facebook, and I hadn't checked my email. I copied my tweets and posted them on Facebook as well, and I watched the post grow there. This whole other audience seemed completely unaware of the situation, and the post grew just as fast there as on Twitter. I checked my email and told my parents I would call them tomorrow. Then I switched back and forth between Facebook and Twitter, checking to see if there was any news, what people were saying to me, and about me. My phone booped, with a text from Maya. "See you tomorrow, I guess," it read. I was so tired, and that sounded like drama that I did not want to deal with. I swiped it away. And then I kept poking and swiping my phone before sleep finally won its war for my consciousness. I'm in the shiny office lobby. The song is playing. The robot waits behind the desk. I approach it. "Hello," it says again. "Hi, can you tell me anything about you?" I say, hoping to engage it in conversation.
"Do you have a passcode?"
it says. "No, but..." And I woke up. But at least now I knew where the song was from. It was the one playing in the dream lobby. It sounded a bit like an elevator music instrumental of a 60s pop song, like "It's Not Unusual." But it wasn't that. It had 100% earwormed into my head, though, and would stay there for pretty much the next 6 months straight. I must have been singing it in the car, I thought. That's how Miranda and Andy had heard it. I'd gotten it stuck in their heads. I'd never been one to have recurring dreams. Certainly there was that one about not going to class all semester and then having to take the test, but everyone had that one. This was the first time I could remember having a dream that seemed so entirely the same as one I had had before. But if there was a part of me that thought this was weird, it was not a loud enough part to prevent me from going the fuck back to sleep, which I did immediately. And you know what I didn't do? I didn't open my phone to look at my text messages. If I had looked, here's the sequence of texts I would have seen from Maya over the past 24 hours. April, 2 a.m. I need to talk about some stuff. Maya, 9:52 a.m. What's up, hon? Maya, 12:12 p.m. April? Maya, 7:02 p.m. Are you okay? Maya, 9:30 p.m. Poke? Maya, 12:12 a.m. See you tomorrow, I guess. I didn't even see Miranda the next morning. Somewhat heroically, Robin met us in the lobby and corralled us all the way to the airport, and then through airport security, and it wasn't until we were boarding that I realized that he had booked a last-minute ticket on our flight back to New York. He had also, amazingly, upgraded me and Andy to first class. "Did you sleep at all?" I asked him after they'd given us our fancy cushy seats. "I did not. I had a lot of emails to send." "You're going to want to get a book deal," he added abruptly. "Why?" "It will help you sway public opinion. Every person who reads your book will be far more likely to be on your side. Books are the most intensive of all current media. People are willing to spend hours and hours with a book. Additionally, people are still willing to pay for them." "I'm getting paid for my YouTube videos already," I said as I scrolled through my Twitter. People were freaking out. I started to type out a tweet because I couldn't help myself. "Video coming later today, editing now. Very weird. Very excited." Robin continued as I typed, "You get paid very poorly for your YouTube videos. You get a fraction of a cent for every person who watches a video. I bet we can get you more than $5 for every person who buys your book." This made my ears perk up. "And how many people do you think would buy my book?" "Hundreds of thousands." He paused before saying, conservatively, "I'm going to want to get a book deal," I told him. "I've also been thinking, I'd like to get an apartment on Carl's block." "Oh, interesting idea. I like it. You can watch over him. Stay informed. I can look into it. Any requirements?"
"Like what?"
"Price range, style," he paused. "Number of bedrooms."
"Oh, right. Maya and I said to Robin,
It's weird. We're roommates, but we're dating, but we're not really at the moving in together stage. We just already were moved in together when we started dating.
That sounds difficult, Robin replied.